My name is Bea Gonzalez, and I am a writer of mostly novels.
And I'm Jay Rettelsberger, a singer-songwriter.
We began a conversation on Twitter some time ago about Carl Jung, art, and the creative process, and we decided to share our discussion with all of you.
So I have some questions for you, because ever since I've known you, I've known you through the way that I first met you was through Twitter, and your Twitter handle is Sophia Cycles. Mm-hmm. And I understand that is a group. You live in Toronto, and you run a group, and that's what you call it. Can you tell me about why, what the impetus for this group was that you started?
Right. So my actual group isn't Sophia Cycles evolved from the group, the whole Sophia Cycles project, which included my Twitter handle, which is how you and I came to start talking about a year ago. But the actual group went through many incarnations, right? So years ago, I was part of a program called Classical Pursuits, where I was invited as some other writers and other people were to lead seminars at the University of Toronto in a program that was held by this private organization. And it was a great concept. I loved it. It was basically, would get together people from actually all over North America and even some from overseas for a week. And there'd be about 10 or 11 seminars and people would be exploring different works. I led one on Don Quixote the first year, and then a couple of others on Jung and Campbell in later years. And then I also led some trips to Spain to study Lorca and to Mexico to study Juan Rulfo, and again to Spain a couple of times to my area of Spain. The point was, what was interesting about that program, and I loved it, was that it followed the Great Books Foundation idea, which is when you gather a bunch of really good readers, people who've really grappled with books in their past and who are older and who've had experience and whatever, you can sit around a table and you can really, through working through the text with curiosity, you can really understand the book in a different way. And it was a fantastic program. And of course, I love literature. That was my background, in part literature and history academically. So I'd love to do that over the week. And the only thing that I missed in that scenario was the metaphorical, the thing we talk about all the time, sort of like when you work with a classical work in that context, you're working with the text. And this is what I really loved about it. There were no experts. You were called a leader, and the leader led the discussion and tried to elicit information by talking to the other person. It's a great thing everybody should learn how to do, because I think it allows for a better conversation. So if you're going to argue that in Don Quixote, Sancho Panza means something, you're going to have to argue why, and you're going to have to point to the text, because the text becomes the expert. You figure that the writer has given you the best thing he can, which is the entirety of his work, of this particular work. If you know more about the context, that's fine, but the work is what's really important. So you avoid talk about, you know, biography. You avoid talking about expert A says this about it, because in many fields like literature and history, the number of opinions on what something means, they're just ridiculous. They go on forever, right? And so it was great because these people, and I think I might have talked about this before, included a nun in her 80s who gave me the best definition of human love I'd heard when we were discussing Don Quixote, which is incredible. Just people who musicians, lawyers, every type of person, all of them only interested in what the text had to say. So while I was doing that program, I thought, well, I'd love to do this with material, but from a metaphorical perspective. So taking the idea that we work with the text, but look at it in a little bit more, the way that we look at dreams, or the way we look at almost from the way you would think about what unconscious created this piece of work. And so I started my own group. And at the beginning, that was really difficult because, you know, you have to find people to want to sit with you. And I kind of tricked people into coming into my living room. I would say, well, why don't you come and have a conversation and hope that they would be interested. And yeah, they were. And I kept sort of here and there, people would tell a friend. Later on, my social media accounts brought me a couple of people. They would contact me, can I join your group? And, you know, I would So yes, after obviously vetting them and saying, making sure they were a good fit, because after a while, I was also responsible to all the members of the group. So anyway, that's how it developed. It developed really from the fact that I'm a huge reader. And I needed people to discuss this with. I don't know if you feel this. I think at a certain point in your life, if you're not in a university setting, let's face it, even a university setting, it's not what I was looking for. I was looking for people like those classical pursuits people that really took this thing seriously, that wanted to talk about the big ideas from this metaphorical perspective and not about their kids and not about their, they can do that elsewhere. When we get together for 4 or 5 hours in my meetings, we discuss whatever it is we're discussing without bringing all the personal stuff in necessarily. So here's the thing. We are not a therapy group. And I tell that to everybody. You do not come in here for therapy. Once someone tried to join who I thought really did need help, and I immediately referred her to a Jungian analyst I knew, because that's not the purpose of our group. We're not experts, and we're not, there is actually a therapist in as part of my group, and she's run a session on art therapy for us, but that's not what we do here. It's just a discussion group. And I, you know, the whole idea I had was, well, why don't we do this? And then let's see if it can be, the original idea was Sophia Circles, but I tried to register that name as a business and it was gone. This isn't really a business. It's a not-for-profit. I don't, you know, this is not selling anything, but I wanted to have something so I could build a website, et cetera. And so Circles wasn't there, but then Cycles actually seemed better. In the end, it's worked out to be exactly what I wanted it to be. But yeah, no, we're not a therapy group. We're just, how do you call it, an exploration. We just want to explore ideas. And yeah, it's been holding strong for, I guess, 15 years now. So must work.
What I've heard you speak of it before, it seems like you explore more than just ideas. For instance, you know, you've talked about doing dream work in your group.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I mean, that is central to what we do. I imagine that I actually just skipped over that. Yeah. I mean, because originally I called the group the Jung group, right? But that didn't make sense because we eventually had more than just Jung and Jungian writers. And here's the other thing. It's not a book group in that I don't assign reading. I do lead it. And so they're kind of being dragged into my world because, you know, every week, as you know me now enough, I'm enthusiastic about a new thing. So they follow me, but nobody, I mean, some people read as much as I do, but really nobody does as much reading as I do. So it really is a discussion of ideas, but you're right. The dream work was because we started as a Jung group. And as you know, and I did some work with Jeremy Taylor, who has a great book, which is sadly hard to find, but that teaches you a lot about how to do dream work in a group setting. Right. And I think actually that is probably the most exciting part of what we do. It started off being, oh, I bring a dream. And now 15 years later, that is a central part of what we do because really our group is trying to address the issues of the unconscious, right? What the unconscious produces. And there isn't anything purer and more important in a way than a dream. So, yes, we are also that.
So the way that I understand it is the material that you read, not necessarily everyone else is reading that, but the material is a primer for conversation. People kind of popcorn, if you will, with that material that you're bringing to the group.
Yes.
So there's spontaneity and just authentic discussion going on.
Right. Oh, yeah, no, great discussion. In fact, our last meeting included what I called headbutting, in that there's a lot of really intelligent people in my group. And we have one particularly well-trained in philosophy who can spot any problem in any argument and go right at it. And that's what I actually appreciate, because I'm testing out a lot of ideas that I myself have read, and I'm not quite sure what to make of them. And the value of a group is that we have, you know, a whole bunch of people with different experiences, certainly very intelligent, who can come back and say, okay, that doesn't make sense to me. So A, it forces me to rearticulate something that, you know, somebody else has said, which is important because you only understand it once you're able to deliver it in a way. And they can poke me. They can say, well, that doesn't make sense. And then I have to go back to it. And so in a way, it helps me test a lot of the things I'm reading. Then, you know me, I'm extremely enthusiastic about things. So if I find a writer with an idea that I find really compelling, I really get enthusiastic, and I want everybody else to sort of in on the party and to tell me what they think. So that is that's one of the things that's really valuable.
So you yourself, although you are the leader,
yep,
quote unquote, you don't see yourself as an expert, and you don't function as an expert
No. I hate, okay, so that's the thing we really need to talk about, because we both have noted that there are people out there almost branding their podcasts or their books or their whatever they're doing as you must only listen to this experts. I'm now referring to the Jungian world in particular. So here's the thing. Jungians particularly, it would be great if everybody had access to Jungian analysis, but we know that is not going to happen. First of all, it's extremely expensive, hard to get in some areas, right? You can't even find a Jungian analyst. Mm-hmm. I suppose you could do it online, but that's not what everybody wants. So the idea that only three people have, and then the second obvious thing to me, and I don't know if you agree with me on this, I'm a big fan, and I post about them all the time, of Inner City Books. They've published, 120, mm-hmm. 150 small books written by Jungian analysts. I am a huge fan of theirs. Mm-hmm. I have probably about 80 of their books. They're fantastic. They are the experts. The book is their expertise mm-hmm. in a book, okay? They argue with each other all the time. Some of their visions, right. not argue with each other, some of their visions don't coincide necessarily. So what do you do at that point? Do you, so the idea is, again, are we mature adults that can sit with different perspectives of different? Now, I think there's a, now see what you think about this, because I thought about it. Well, you and I are doing this as part of the way I looked at it. Gatherings for me was always an extension of the Sophia outreach that I do, the ideas that I love. You happen to be my first international member, really, that I consider part of the group, and the group knows about you and loves your music, and is, you're sort of one of us, even though you're not in the room. Although there has been suggestions that we need to beam you in, but I don't think you would really enjoy that. You'd be all talking all over you. Anyway, so to me, this isn't, I'm not trying to get anything out of this. Just like my group, I'm not trying to, I'm not trying to make money off people. I'm not trying to sell anything. Yes, I would love it if people bought my book and people listened to your music. But at the end of the day, none of this is monetized. None of this is making anybody any money. And I think a lot of the people who are complaining are monetized and do want to monetize and get very weird about other people having access on a higher, just having a bigger vase. Then they have scarcity consciousness. It's like, listen, there are a lot, if somebody out there is misinforming the public is, they're not in, people who follow Jungians are pretty well-versed. This is a very minor little subject that a lot of people aren't that interested in. So first of all, it's not like we're not aiming to bring in thousands of people. So I think, I wonder if it's just protection of territory. That's what's happening there. It's like, you shouldn't have access, or because if they're trying to defend Jung, I think would be horrified by some of and that was said by other people, not by me, by some of the associations that were created post his death. And again, the professionalization and the disputes that happened between the groups in the 70s and the 80s were, purportedly epic. So I think he would say, listen, this is all about, yes, read all the experts. And if you can afford to go to Jungian analyst, by all means, do that. But isn't the core of his work, listen to your own inner self, your inner guidance, once you figured out, how to talk to that part of yourself? Or am I getting this all wrong?
No, that's what it is. That's exactly what it is. And I think that there's the thing about conversation, real conversation, is it removes the idea of authority. We need experts. We need experts in all kinds of areas, for sure. But who's an expert on my experience? Who's an expert on your experience? No one. You are. Right. You are. And people coming together and having conversations, which is what you and I do, that's what we're doing. It's a very organic thing, and I think it's a healthy thing, and it's a purposeful thing. This idea that, I'm not here to steer anyone or throw pearls of wisdom at anyone. I'm just naturally curious about the content.
Yeah, that's my basic approach as well. One of the things you do in a Classical Pursuits or a Great Books Foundation type of scene or discussion is everybody sits in a circle. There is no sage on the stage. There is nobody there to try to tell you what to think about something, because you're dealing with literature in that case. In this case, we're working sometimes through some Jungian texts, but we went through 2 years working with the classics. I made them all go through everything from Gilgamesh to Aeschylus to Sophocles to the Iliad, the Odyssey, because my big interest, of course, is how to connect all these things. And so why would I even think that I could lecture with someone? And again, we go back to the fact that I come from a background in history and literature where three experts will see one character in one novel in vastly different ways. So we're all dealing with perspectives. This isn't hard science where facts are there. This is interpretive to a certain degree. But as you said, ultimately, when you get into the dream world, when we interpret, we use something Jeremy Taylor actually was very emphatic about, and which I think is good, which is, let's say someone says a dream. Now, remember, we're a dream group, and we know quite a bit about our inner lives because we've been sharing our inner lives for a while. We ask the context of the dream. In other words, what's been happening to you in the last couple of days? That's one of the things. How did you feel? What feeling can you connect to it? But if we're going to make a comment about the dream, we always preface it with, if this were my dream. Because it's not my dream. And the only person who ultimately is the authority on your dream is you. How could I possibly know? Because it's your inner parts of yourself speaking to you, not to me. And so the idea would be absurd. So you yes. And by the way, having gone through hours upon hours of Jungian analysis myself, because my intention was at the beginning to actually go into a training program. My own analyst at the time deterred me from that to somewhat. And also I wasn't really interested. I mean, I keep saying, I really wasn't that interested. I was publishing a second novel. I had small children, just wasn't in the works. But she knew that the reason I kept going to see her was so that I could talk about this stuff. So she said, you need people to talk to. And I thought, okay, that's why I started recruiting or asking people if they were interested in this kind of stuff. And but one thing about being in Jungian analysis is that my analysts never told me what a dream of mine meant either. I mean, you're working with them and in overhearing yourself speak and in sharing some of the images, I'm sure this has happened because we've talked about our dreams. You just click, you know when something makes sense to you and you know when something does not feel right, because really it's a feeling state that reveals whether you're on the right track or not. And sometimes you'll have a dream and you won't figure it out for, I don't know, months or maybe never. I mean, it's something that's always working there. But no, nobody is the expert. We are all here to help you overhear yourself, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And I think actually that is why conversation really works. We're getting to the value of conversation, which I don't think is happening in a healthy way in a lot of places. Someone the other day posted a quote, and I don't know who the person, I can't remember who the person saying this, but it's irrelevant. It's actually the gist of the quote was that, most people know what's wrong with them, but they need a space. They need someone to elucidate from them what that is. And that is really what a good analyst does, probably a good therapist, anybody working in that field. You know, only you can know, but it's the person that's just trying to guide you for you to reach a level of understanding. Because if you tell me what's wrong with me, I'm just going to get belligerent against you. I mean, I may be nice to your face, but I'll be angry because you are telling me. Most of us react in an egoic way. We get a little bit threatened. You have to come to that realization yourself. So that's what I'm hoping the group, and we're not trying to get to that. We're just trying to understand something about ourselves through not only the ideas and the dream work and other things involving the imagination we do, hypnosis we work with a whole bunch of different things, but to really understand ourselves better. I guess that's the ultimate goal of what we're doing, and maybe lessen the burden of others, like we place on others through our projections and through all the stuff that I think Jung rightly identified. Yeah.
Please don't say that you heard me cry.
If someone were going to want to start a similar group, a group that forms the same function or has the same function, how would they go about doing that?
Well, they'd go to a soccer field where their kids are training and they'd start talking to people and say, would you like to talk about obscure 19th century opera with me? I think it really depends. Okay, a couple of things. I think it really depends on what kind of person you are. Do you want to have these conversations? And B, do you have an insatiable curiosity that will be, because look, there's no expert, but there has to be somebody that leads somebody into a conversation of some form, right? I find once people are on the table, the conversation then, whatever you brought to the table changes into something that's more necessary. Yeah. So it's just bringing a hook. It's like saying, okay, this time we're going to talk about this because I happen to be reading that. But weirdly, when we've noted this in our 4 or 5 hour sessions, that at the end of it, sometimes something magical happened in that something that really needed to be heard by a specific person happened that day, but that was not the intention. It just worked out. So really, if you want to form a circle, you form a discussion group. You find people who are there who want to tackle on some big issues. I have to say, and you and I both know this, it does take some humility on the part of all the people involved, because a lot of the times, and I remember somebody saying that to me after we read a couple of Hollis books, James Hollis books, you know, this is bad because now I can't blame anybody, right? This is one of the problems with this type of work, that if you're forcing, to some degree, you're forcing yourself to take responsibility for stuff that would have been easier prior to you coming into contact with this way of thinking through the Jungians, definitely, and through other thinkers as well. You could have laid at other people's feet. I mean, that's what you would have done in the past. And I don't think that works once you start reading this stuff, because you realize, A, that it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And B, the other thing you realize is that actually that's not even very empowering. It's a lot more empowering, even though it's, you know, I can't blame mother, father, sister, you know, whoever you want to blame for your life. It actually allows you to take back that kind of that authority for yourself, so that you can say, okay, well, this is me. This is the whole show is me. So I better start addressing it. James Hollis famously said, look, the only person on the stage of your life always is you. There's nobody else. They're all supporting characters. So if you don't start looking at situations that appear in your life as something that you have somehow drawn to you, you know, you're always going to be blaming others for your circumstances. So anyway, that would be the out, one of the things that does happen by being part of it. It does humble you, I think.
Certainly. Any advice that you would give for anyone starting?
Well, vet people very carefully. And this is serious, because you will get people that really do need help. And, if, you know, like I said, we're not a therapy group. Maybe there's a therapist that wants to try it. That's a different story. Mm-hmm. This is really people who are committed to an honest exploration. The other thing is, you're going to butt heads. That's, and I love these people very much, but there are days that, you know, we get into some heated moments, but we've never not ended up saying this was a great experience. And so to also allow yourself, leave the ego somewhere outside the door, because you're going to be disarmed. And also, I think, and to see what you think about this, I think revealing your dreams to somebody is much more personal. I don't know half of what goes on in some of these people's lives, by the way, their personal lives. I don't know what's happening. I don't care. I don't think they care about what's going on in mine. But what they're revealing through their dreams, I think, is 10,000 times more intimate and open, makes someone a little bit more vulnerable than anything they could be revealing. Because I think when you reveal things about yourself to somebody else, you're doing it from the perspective of where the persona, you know, the mask is on. Mm-hmm. You want to present a certain part of yourself in a certain way. You will tell a story in a certain way. Your dreams don't do that. Your dreams are pretty honest. They come out. In fact, you know, I'm sure there's lots of dreams we don't bring to the table because we know they're just way too honest, and it's hard to even talk about. But even a dream that you think is, you know, so it's just a minor little dream, and then we start working on it, and it reveals a great deal about the person.
Yeah.
So with dream work, I think that's an area that it would be good if someone got some training. I do think that even if you don't get the training, if you work with a Jungian analyst or you read a book, Jeremy Taylor, when he was alive, had that program. But if you read his book, you know, just to understand how to, because there are minefields there. And then the second thing is, honestly, if someone asked me what the whole Sophia Cycles project is about, whether it's Twitter or Instagram or what we're doing here together or my novel, it's really about getting people to understand that a metaphorical view of life is actually so enriching that it takes you away from fundamentalism and thought in behavior sometimes. And so the thing about dreams is that's really the fast track to understanding how to think metaphorically, because with dreams, you can't think literally. You're in a world that is metaphorical, in my understanding, mythological in a big way. And you have to enter that kind of thinking, or it's not even thinking. What would you call that? You just have to enter a world where the attaching things to reality doesn't quite work there. It's a completely different game, right? So, mm-hmm. so that I think would be the, I think somebody, if you're going to do that kind of work, you should maybe investigate a little bit about how to go about doing it. Because I think there are mines there, traps anyway.
Tell me about the project you're starting.
So what we decided as a group, because we've been together for so long, is that we'd, people always ask, well, what are you guys doing? And can I join? And I'm not really allowing anybody to join at this moment, just because I can't accommodate more people. But what we decided as a group, because like I said, I have people who've been with the group, you know, 10, 12 years, some actually the original members 15 years, so long time, is to start doing these programs that would be fundamentally recreating what we do in an afternoon here, but in a public setting. And when I say public, I don't mean a vast, but we're talking maybe 30 people at most. And for example, our first event is going to be in Toronto in April, and it won't be, we're not doing big outreach there. It's going to be people connected to us who have asked us in the past, well, what are you doing? And we'll probably start with dreams, because, okay, this is a good question, because we've talked about in our group and you are part of the group. If you were going to start with this whole project, does that seem like the one thing to start with? I mean, we thought that was a central part of what we did.
Can you be a little more detailed with this? What about dreams? Can you tell me
how this would look like? Is that?
Yes. What this would look like.
Well, we're still trying to understand. So, you know, there's a lot of really creative people in my group. That's part of one of what's been great about. And I think that's part of why you and I started speaking, because you are another creative. And I'm really fascinated by the connection between creativity and the unconscious. And so I have a filmmaker, I have a photographer, I have many, many visual artists, writers, you know, everything. And so one of the ideas is to put on one of our members, Mona Zaidi, is a great theater director and performer and writer. And she did, for a private thing they did, I couldn't make it, but they had a kind of a full moon ceremony, sort of a ritual sort of gathering a while back. She put on a short metaphorical play on, and she might do something again like that. So just to set the scene, like we're entering, it's like, you know, you enter a world and you're just marking, hey, here are the rules that apply outside don't apply anymore. So we would start with something like that. One of the ideas we had was to demonstrate what a dream analysis session would look like by just as a small group saying, okay, here someone's brought a dream. What do we do with it? And then, of course, I would probably give an intro just about the approach. And I would use, you know, some of what I've learned from Jeremy Taylor's mm-hmm. approach. But then we would break out into three groups of 10. And we would have three facilitators in each group, including, you know, anybody that was in my group would be a facilitator. And we'd ask people to bring a dream. And we'd work with their dreams if they're willing. And with three facilitators, and we'd sit in a circle and we'd get people so they understand what happens when we get together and see how that goes. And of course, at the end, we do, and we finish, because one of the members of our group is actually behind some of the best restaurants we have in Toronto at one point. So we are obviously going to end with some wine and some food, because that's what you should do, you know, at the end of a harrowing 4 hours of dream interpretation. That's what it looks like now. We're going to tweak it. But that would be the first one. That would be the first. And I think for people who've never done dream interpretation, I did a weekend years and years ago. I took a weekend, a bunch of them away for just up north here for a weekend, where we worked all day, all weekend on dreams. And I remember there's a woman who joined us who wasn't really part of the group, but she'd been part of my Classical Pursuits class that I did on artistic inspiration. So she said, okay, I'd like to come. And I said, okay. When she said, but I never dream. I'm a chemist. I have a PhD in chemistry and I don't have dreams. So I said, well, yeah, you do have dreams, but you know, you're probably not attentive to them. So anyway, she showed up and her dream was one image. And we spent an hour and a half going through that image. And that's the point about them, that what you don't think is important, once you start speaking to others and connecting things, it is amazing what even one image can reveal. So that's what I'm hoping will happen here, because it was very intense. Ultimately, Jay, what we'd like to do is we would like to do longer sessions and even trips like I used to do for Classical Pursuits. Mm-hmm. So we do dream analysis, but maybe in my part of Spain, which is called, dreamy Spain, because it's Celtic and it's always foggy and be a great ideal place. And it's the place of the witches. And it'd be fantastic to do something there, which would incorporate what I used to do with Classical Pursuits, which I could tell history of the place and the food. And it becomes kind of an experience. Because what I found is I took a group of my group to my part of Spain in about 5 years ago for a great trip. when you're doing this on like an intense level, you're getting up in the morning and you're with the same people, and it is very, very powerful what happens. Just something starts changing. And it's like an immersion experience, except you're not immersing mm-hmm. yourself in a language experience. You're immersing yourself in a, your whole outlook is being changed. So, and again, when I used to do the trips for Classical Pursuits, and now for the one I did to Galicia, they're small groups. You don't have more than 12, 15 people. If you have more than that, it's too hard because, you know, it's just, it has to be intimate groups, but they're great experiences. So that's a long-term goal, like maybe a year or 2 years down the line, mm-hmm. depending on what kind of people are interested. Is there interest? Would people want to do this? You know, because maybe we're all deluded. Maybe we're the only people in Toronto and in the world that actually finding this experience as great as, you never know, right? Sometimes because we're having experience doesn't mean everybody is going to enjoy this. So we'll see.
Well, no, not everybody, but I think from some of the feedback and questions that you get, I definitely think you've generated a lot of curiosity about it.
Yeah, I think the thing is that it's hard to talk about. I mean, as I'm speaking to you about this, I'm not really communicating what happens because you can't really explain. There's something alchemical that happens in a room where people do start talking about their dreams and their inner lives. And I can't describe that experience. You have to be in the room. One of the members of the group always says, I feel nourished after leaving this mm-hmm. meeting. I feel like I've been fed. And that's how we all feel. But to describe why that's happening, I couldn't tell you. If I just line by line explained, I don't think I would capture what really goes on. You really have to go through a session and then mm-hmm. see, okay. And that's why I would always keep this to very small groups, because I think once you make it too large, people are afraid to talk, first of all. I mean,
right.
You know, and so that doesn't work. The other curious thing, by the way, which you're the first male member really who stuck with it. And so for years, there haven't been a lot of men who've been invited in the group. And you're stuck with it because you're really doing a one-on-one. I wonder if I put right. you in there.
Right. You're giving me way too much credit.
Well, no. I mean, in the sense that, I think you would be interested in the conversations. And I know that you'd be interested in the dream interpretation because you've done it. And I know you've been interested in the creative aspect because, like I said, the vast majority, all of the people in my group are involved in some creative activity or another. And you're part of that for that reason. So that part would not be hard. I think a couple of men who have walked into the group either said this is too intense. And I took that to be, and you know, okay, listen, I understand because they're surrounded by women too. And that's not really, you'd want a more balanced kind of thing. So I'm hoping that with the outreach that we start getting men involved too, because it's really necessary to have it. Not that it matters in the end of the day, but you know, different perspectives, right?
I will say the depth psychology program I was in was very experiential, and we did all of this, and it was very lopsided women to men ratio. And that wasn't a problem for me then. So I don't think being in your group would be a problem for me now.
I don't think so. I think you're going to find that all the time. There's always going to be more women in these groups than men for whatever reason. It doesn't matter that. And at the end of the day, it's never made our group worse. Honestly, I don't know because we didn't, but it didn't. I didn't think, oh, geez, I wish I had a couple more men in these groups. It's always interesting if people want to show up and have the discussions, but it doesn't really matter. When we do the outreach, I think it would be interesting to have, just because sometimes you do get a different perspective. I've certainly gotten a different perspective from you. That's normal. I mean, we are living different experiences in some regard, not in mm-hmm. all of it, but there are some differences, right? So that would be interesting to see. I think in the trips I used to do for Classical Pursuits, you'd get a mixture, but they were literature. We talk about Lorca, you know? And talking about literature, there's always a distance that you can put between you and, you know,
it's the poems.
It is safer. It's, this isn't so safe sometimes. Some stuff that comes out doesn't feel safe, right? So, it'll be interesting to see if it could happen.
I think it would be difficult. Like, I've always thought of this. I know you say it's not therapy. And it's not. No. But I could see how sometimes it might be easy for those lines to be blurred.
Yes, you have to be careful about that, right? Now, Look, by this time, we all really care about each other, so we're supportive of each other. I mean, women are therapists to each other anyway. That's the basis of a lot of female relationships. And by the way, why I think we live longer, because we are somebody, we discuss things and we share things. And so it's just a way of, and the other thing that's been great is that the age spread that I've had in this group has been tremendous. I've had people as young as their early 20s, right to the member who passed away, sadly, 5 years ago, who was almost 80. So when you get that kind of, and everything in between, so you get these different perspectives from people at different points of life. Mm-hmm. And it's good for the younger, she told me, just lovely, she's an artist who's now living in London. But as she said, it was really important for her to listen to perspectives that were not from her own age group, who take things so seriously. And then, you know, you look at, some people who've been around a while who may not take a lot of the things that seem so urgent to a 23-year-old, just 30 years down the line, just doesn't seem that urgent. Let's just be honest, right? Mm-hmm. So it's good. I like that mixture as well. But no, ultimately, it is therapeutic because we care about each other. And I think the foundation of therapy is that, I heard Hollis say this actually once, that he loves his patients. And that's why he wants to continue doing the work he does. You develop a real closeness with the people that you're tending to. And so in a group like this, we all have that same level of emotion, I think, for each other, which is why it's safe. Bitten by the language of your Soho. I've made, and I don't know if this is a good rule or a bad rule, but I will stick to it, is I don't want partners in here with, if that makes any sense.
Yes, think, it does.
Okay. It does, you know what? You sense. See that? You see, yes. I don't think, and that includes mine. You can't be here. The reason being is I don't think the level of honesty, and this is, and it may be some can, but I think it could create a feeling that somebody isn't, even with a dream, you know, that it's a little bit raw and you're afraid that you're suddenly going to be finding yourself in the middle of some sort of interchange that you don't want to be in the middle of, if that makes any sense. Or, but my biggest concern was really that it would restrain one of the two, so that someone wouldn't say something because their partner was there. And that's like, that's not the purpose of our, you know, we want people. That's the only rule I've had. No children, no partners, no. I don't even think siblings are a good idea, honestly.
Right.
Because I think even with siblings, there are minefields that are there that the ego gets ruffled, and then, you know, we've lost the plot. So generally, I like it when there's no connection of that nature. Friends, sure, why not? It doesn't matter. But, and some of us, all of us have become good friends anyway. But I think that's one thing that, which kind of raises a question for me. What kind of relationships are we all having? That you can be completely open in a group like this, right? But that many of us would feel less capable or wanting to share these kinds of things with people who are close to us. And maybe that's just, it's the nature of the way that, I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. I'm just going to go on somewhere, but I have no idea.
I was going to say that most of you know each other through the groups. I mean, you're the central right. piece. I mean, but from the get-go, you're connecting on a deeper level than people typically are in their day-to-day relationships. I mean, from the get-go, you really are, because you're discussing this material that brings things forth from the unconscious, and that's where real connection is. I think it's beneath, you know, the day-to-day humdrum. And that makes sense to me, that you would feel a deeper connection with the women in your group than you would maybe.
It's a different connection. I mean, honestly, it's different. Yeah, I would say there are two worlds that can meet, I guess, and don't. And often we have partners who are not as interested in this work as well, by the way. It's not like everybody has a partner that's going, wow, this sounds really interesting. For many, it's not that interesting. In fact, one of the partners of one of the members who we have dinner at his house, he feeds us sometimes, is not at all interested. And is like, no, and makes jokes about it. I completely understand. But I think it's an interesting question about, because in the classical pursuits world, couples would be in the same class and there was no problem. And in fact, they'd often say after, I didn't know that you know, my husband or this or that, he thought the things that he did until we entered that room. But there seems to be, and that just shows you how powerful the stuff that we're discussing is. There seems to be a line that can't be crossed when it comes to stuff like this and what you feel comfortable with around, even like I said, like your closest siblings or whatever. Because I think with siblings, with partners, there's a history that you're also having mm-hmm. to contend with. Whereas one of the best things I can say about my group is early on, about we were about 5-6 years into the group, two of the members ended up at the same talk, I think by Umberto Eco, and they were sitting there and, oh, hi, you know, and they had the partners with them. And they started talking and they said, oh, yeah, we know each other from this group. And they would say, you know, the usual thing people say when they're in a social situation, oh, what do you do? And it soon became apparent that the two of the women that were there did not know what each other did in their so-called mm-hmm. day world. And the partners were blown away. He said, how could that be? You've known each other for 5 years. You spend 4 or 5 hours in a room together, you know, at least once a month. What's going on? But that just wasn't relevant. And that's what's good about it.
There's a shared intention and a mutual willingness for vulnerability.
Yep.
That's what I hear.
And that's, I think, what happens. But again, let's to the point that what we talk about here is that it comes through the unconscious, sharing unconscious material, which I think people don't quite understand is powerful. Because, you know, you'll tell the average person out there, well, I spent 4 hours doing dream analysis with people, and they think, okay, sure. But what they don't understand is the level of information that is giving to yourself first, but that the rest of the group is also participating in mining and helping you mine. I don't think people understand this, which is why we thought when we were going to plan out our first venture out into the world that it had to be dreams, because that is the number one thing that has generated, I think, for all of us. And it's not only your dream. Listening to other people's dreams is mm-hmm. very powerful. I actually prefer that to anything that anybody can give to me as a theory they have or an idea they want to share, because the dream is raw. It's totally, it's what I think is the real person, the real unconscious speaking. And we've had this experience that is almost spooky, and that often someone will bring a dream that is relevant to all of us in different ways mm-hmm. on that particular day. And we don't know why, but it just spoke to us. And that's magic. I mean, that's when you leave mm-hmm. off. You almost think that person has had that dream for all of us. And, you know, maybe, yeah, we could be reading into it, but I don't know. But it's happened more than once.
I don't know about that. I don't know about, I think when you start getting embedded in a group, I think there is a group unconscious. Yep. If you will. And there, you know, sometimes it hits, sometimes one member of a group will express something through a dream that is for everyone. I mean, yeah. I really think that happens.
Did that happen to you in the Sonoma thing? Sonoma program. Yeah. I think this does happen. I think if you have the right leaders, and that when I say leaders, I mean, not experts, but I mean, people who give space to that and who don't shut it down and who allow everybody their say, it's almost like a transcendent experience, and that is as close to I get to a religious experience mm-hmm. in the world. I don't go to church. This is my participation with it. And I think the unconscious contents are sort of that kind of experience anyway.
Certainly.
They're extremely deep. So I'm sad that a lot of people, you know, you'll get people saying, oh, that's just crazy or whatever, but because you're almost missing out information that should you know it. And I do really think, you know, the idea that a dream is like an unopened, an unexplored dream is like an unopened letter. It goes right back, I think, to the Talmud, mm-hmm. but it's the idea that you do have to work with it. And von Franz said that. I know words people say, like Hellman was I think almost you can't say attach words to images, and to me that's silly. The only thing we have, right, honestly, he said we have to create an image to match another image. That sometimes is impossible. What we have are questions. Like one of the great things about the classic pursuits model was question. Are you good at the follow-up question? Which means you've mm-hmm. been listening really carefully, or otherwise you can't have a follow-up question. And are you good at knowing does this make sense? Like connecting it to, in that case, the text. In this case, the person, right? Because sometimes I find when you're doing dream interpretation, right? For me too, this is not just me listening, but me doing it for myself. The obvious is too easy to get to, but it's obviously the things you cannot see that really the dream is trying to communicate, right? I mean, the dream is trying to compensate for something that's out of whack, I think, internally, mm-hmm. or revealing something that you think you figured out and you haven't figured out. And so sometimes you don't want to consciously admit that. It feels, and so you'll go down another path. But as you talk about it with others, what I find is eventually you get, I just always think, if I let the person, actually, there's a great quote by Jung where he said, all men are liars, but if they sit in a chair long enough and I let them talk, eventually they get to the truth. Okay, taking away the word liar, which is extreme, I think that's the same way that with the unconscious. You're not lying as much as everything is hidden, but if you talk about it long enough and you listen to yourself talk, or you have somebody listening to repeat the words back to you, because that's actually, I think, one of the things we do most in our group, which is let the person talk and then rearticulate for them what they just said, because they've said it not listening to themselves sometimes. And then it clicks. They go, oh my God, that's it. And it's like, when you see that happen, it is the look of recognition and relief in their faces. It's fantastic. It's so neat. And for all of us watching, it's just equally as good. I was just wanting to get back to the expert thing for a second, in that, again, we are living in a kind of a weird world where, you know, people are lying about facts that are really important not to lie about, without getting, it doesn't matter what they're about. So everything is being blurred, right? And so the expert, I do want to make a case for experts are absolutely needed. And I am in debt to companies like Inner City Books that are publishing the words of people who have struggled with ideas, just like I'm in debt to all these great classical authors who have left us their work, because we're still struggling and we're reinterpreting them as we go, because what happens is that we also change our minds about things and the context is different. But the idea, again, of saying that only certain people have the right to speak about Jung's work is absolutely horrifying to me. I don't know if it's horrifying to you, but it's just antithetical to what I think the man's work was about. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm totally reading him incorrectly. I don't know.
No, I don't. And I think I've said something like this to you before. There's a reason. I don't want to use the C word.
I'm not sure which C word you're thinking of, but many are very bad, and I don't want you to use them. I don't know what you're thinking.
Cult. That's the C word, where the person becomes bigger than the work is, and you know, well, how dare you speak on this? This is not. The work is the work, and it's to be applied, and it's to be discussed, and it's to be worked over. It's a living thing. It's not this stoic idealism.
So
I would think that's what Jung would want it to be.
Yeah, I'm thinking the same thing. Also, you brought up something that I started out with the ideas business, but really what's really powerful in what we do here aren't the ideas. They are the inner worlds that we're exploring, right? Our inner worlds, and listening to each other's inner worlds, not the outer story, not what you ate for dinner and who you know and what you do for a living. I could care less, or your children, whatever. Those are concerns that you can take to another place. That's not what we really want to focus on here. I don't think there is many spaces where you can talk about your inner world. And when I hear someone say, oh, that's dangerous if you don't have an expert in the room, I think that's insane, frankly, because it presupposes that we're all so ill that we can't talk about something like our inner selves without having a so-called expert in the room. And by the way, let me just say that as many people have found, who have done analysis with more than one Jungian. You're not even a match for a lot of people that are out there. There's just this mm-hmm. thing that, you know, so the whole thing is, while it's helpful, I'm saying that I find it offensive to believe that people cannot get together and discuss these things and not somehow end up in, oh, you know, without being ending up mentally ill.
I think there's a danger in that as well, as having to have an authoritative figure in the room, because that develops some type of dependency. Because you can't question that person.
Yeah, that's it.
You could, you know, that person has all the answers. How dare, you know, so that really takes away from the work that you do in your group. That would take away from the work that you do in your group.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want experts here, and I would never, we've had people come in and sort of, you know, there are different people that share with us some type of knowledge we don't have. That's all great, but we still sit in a circle and we question but ultimately the thing, and this is why the dream work is so important. The authority always ends with you. Each person is the authority mm-hmm. of their own dream, of their own inner world. We can only comment with that little phrase, which I think is brilliant at the beginning, which is, if this were my dream, if this were my story. Part of what we do is we also try to story our lives in some way through narrative, through saying, okay, well, if I could, and I made you do this early on in our conversations when you ended up in a cave. But it's a way of working with metaphor to understand, because I think what we get into problems if we're too literal about our experiences, then we get too much into the emotions, because then the past comes in and intrudes and makes us reactive. But I think when you're looking at it metaphorically, you can take that step back, where you turn yourself into something that can be watched, mm-hmm. that observer effect comes in a lot easier. And you can't do that if you're recounting something that actually happened to you. The emotions will get in the way. But if you can make it into a story, once upon a time, so and so did, and you're not, while talking about the event, you're actually not talking about the event, or you're not even talking about an event, you're talking about a larger piece of who you are, it makes for an entirely different conversation. And that conversation, and you know, we've done that as well, is really powerful, because it's getting to what really matters. If you're told, listen, you're going to write something over a day and a half, it has to be metaphorical. You can't talk about I'm Jay and I'm so and so and I'm this many years old and all the things we tell people, right? You just get rid of all that. And I say, just make it into a story about some magical kingdom that you put the person in. It does change. It allows the freedom to speak about things. And yet, you're speaking about it allegorically or metaphorically or whatever, but in the end, it's so much truer to who you are. That's all I can say that I've seen and experienced. So as a subsequent event, that's one I would like to do, where people do just that. They write their own fairy tale about themselves in a page and a half, and then you read it out loud. And you'd be surprised at what emerges from just that exercise, you know? And that really, it really reveals layers to yourself that you didn't even know existed. It's really interesting.
I was thinking about the expert thing, and I was thinking, like, if a person, you know, were to read scripture and they were always going to their pastor or their priest, tell me what this means. Tell me, well, then why even read it? Yeah. Why even read it if you're going to get, you know, some answer from an authority figure? Why even bother?
Well, because I think that's certainty, though, isn't it? That feels safe.
Well, yes.
Somebody's telling you what to do, right? It's a lot. It's a lot less safe to say, no, I'm going to. And again, you know, you and I are straddling a very fine line here, because that does not mean I'm going to then go out there and figure out molecular biology and figure out how my body's working. We're talking about things where interpretation are actually really important, right? This is the left-right world, brain world we've talked about. This is not the world where, there's a dance. You can understand it on many different levels. It's not. So just to keep repeating that, because I think there is a danger here in applying this with a broad stroke to everything. That's not what I'm trying to do at all. And I don't think you are either. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, the authority. I mean, isn't this why there was a Protestant Revolution? Because you wanted to retain authority or reclaim authority from the Pope. And what came because it was literacy, right? You suddenly had access to the actual written word, and you work with it.
But you just can't. You just came with another form of authority.
What do you mean? Oh, sure. The written word from the. Well, what have you, I just quoted this guy and I can't remember his name. He was quoted by Patrick. Harper. I don't think his first name was Harper, Patrick, but it was Harper for sure. Tom Harper, I think, who wrote The Pagan Christ. The name will come to me afterwards. Okay. So it's a great book. And it was written here. It was a, he's a theologian here in Anglican theologian here in Toronto, taught at the University of Toronto, also wrote a religion, which is kind of interesting, a religion column for the Toronto Star, which is our largest circulation newspaper in Canada. And he came to the conclusion that he'd been reading the Bible all wrong, that the Bible had to be read metaphorically. And that it wasn't that he suddenly came to this realization. And this is where it gets interesting. He realized that that's the way it was originally intended. And through the years, because of, you know, politics and control and, you know, everything gets institutionalized, that reading of it had been lost and we'd become, you know, we concretize everything. There was such a person and this did happen. And the whole thing became a historical record. And it's not, it wasn't meant that way. That was his belief about it. But here's what was interesting about it. I mean, he really generated a lot of controversy because, of course, it was like, how dare you? And at the end of it, he said, having reached that conclusion, he developed more faith than he had before because he understood the world archetypally and he understood that this was a beautiful living document that spoke metaphorically to him, right? And that had great truths. Just like, you know, he also said, look, you can read any of the great texts, any of the great spiritual texts, and you will get to the same realization. The moment you literalize, you lose the essence of what this means, right? And I think that the reason that my group means so much to me is we don't literalize. We always work on that assumption that you can read the world metaphorically. So we always say, if this were to be read that way, what does this mean? You could take this to extreme levels and play with it. It's not just our dreams. What if you apply that to a lot of what you, what happens in life? It's another level of reality. I'm not saying that the other doesn't, but it does actually allow you some distance and to put things into a larger context. So it's a really powerful way of thinking. But, you know, I don't think it's a way of thinking that's necessary. In fact, I think most people don't accept this. But for me, it has really allowed me to see the world in a completely different way. And I'll go with what, I think it was Crossan's, John, I think your friend even commented on this on Twitter. The idea that that is what, how they weren't, that the, this is the way these stories, because they're stories again too. I mean, they're not even, it's not like in 19, you know, whatever. It's extremely, there are stories created to make you understand greater truths. And the reason I love that is that I'm a storyteller. So to me, the idea is that you are too, with your songwriting, you can tell a deeper truth through a narrative like that than you can in the once upon a time, not once and upon a time, sorry, in the hard historical fact. You were doing the once upon a time. So I don't know. Maybe it's delusional, but it seems to work. At least for me, it does. Yeah. Thanks for listening. If you like Jay's music and would like to support the creation of more, follow the link to the GoFundMe page in the show notes. You can support my work by buying my new novel, Invocation, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and through many booksellers across the world. For now, until next time. Singing.